The 1960s were the most dominant decade in all of professional sports, and it was executed by your Boston Celtics. We're starting our deep dive of the Boston Celtics' reign of terror in the 60s on this Tuesday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go. Rain and Jay's back with the vengeance at all the real Celtics fans in attendance. This is the truth like 34. It's like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. Crowd goes crazy, most in-depth coverage on the daily, mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings, focus like Danny at the deadline, global but it got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line, play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day, trying to stay in tune with the C's, that's the best way. Melly. John Corral is here from MassLive.com, thanking you again for making this podcast part of a daily routine that I know has changed a lot. But if you're a part of this show on a daily basis, still, I really do appreciate it. Thank you for continuing to download the shows, listen to it wherever you're going. If you're still going to work, good for you. I'm glad that you're still employed. Those of you who are struggling through this, I hope we can find a way to get you some help and we can all get through a very difficult time in American history. My part in all of this is trying to give you some normalcy and to continue to give you this podcast on a daily basis as a form of kind of just escape. We can continue to talk about basketball. On this podcast, we're starting our deep dive into the 60s. If you missed last week, we did the 50s. This week it's the 60s, and we're starting with Sam Jones, who is starting to come into his own. Bill Russell, you know, the dominance, the Celtics winning in every year except for one. The emergence of Wilt Chamberlain as a giant obstacle on the way to Boston Celtics dominance. There's so much to get into here. I'm going to get into that with Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com. First, I want to shout out Jason Tatum, who is doing a fundraiser with the Greater Boston Food Bank. If you go to the Greater Boston Food Bank, and you can find his page there to donate. He's matching. If you scroll down on the their website, it's GBFB, Greater Boston Food Bank, GBFB.org. If you scroll down, Team JTO is his fundraiser, and he's going to match $250,000 to the Greater Boston Food Bank. And it's part of a partnership with Bradley Beal to help Feeding America, to help the St. Louis area food bank. Since he's from St. Louis, he and Bradley Beal are combining to donate $500,000 to feed people. I'm a big supporter of the Greater Boston Food Bank. I do a lot of my own personal fundraising for the Greater Boston Food Bank. Little bits here and there whenever we can. And so I would like to encourage people to donate to this. I told people on Twitter, I'm going to tell you, I'll match up to $250. Jason Tatum makes a few more zeros than I do, so he can match up to a few more zeros than I can. But I'll tack on $250 to this. So it's a way to just feed people who are struggling through this very difficult, unprecedented time. So Jason Tatum announced that today, on Monday, I should say, and is raising money to help feed people in Boston and St. Louis. If you want to go GBFB.org, GBFB.org, and scroll down, you'll see the Team JT0. Go ahead and do that. If you make a donation, you want to tweet it at me at RedsArmy_John. I'll tack on $250 to that to help the cause. And as a thank you to Jason Tatum, as a thank you to you guys, and you know, to help people around here in Boston who need an extra helping hand. You guys continue to support the podcast. This is going to be my way of helping and trying to pay it forward, using some of the money that's coming into the podcast to go ahead and donate that to people who need it a lot more than I do. I'm lucky in this pandemic, in this crazy time, that my life is less impacted than most. The only thing I'm missing is basketball. I'm still employed and I'm still doing the podcast, and luckily things are going better for me than for most. So let's, if you're in this same situation, let's take a little bit of what we can. I know it's still, it's not great, but let's take a little bit of what we can and pull it together and help people who are in need. So shout out to Jason Tatum for that. Okay, let's get back to talking some basketball. Me, Mike, we spent 2 hours on a call on Monday talking about the entire 1960s. So I'm going to give it to you in the four sections, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Today, we're taking you all the way up until the LA Lakers. And right now, we're going to talk about Sam Jones. We're going to talk about a little bit of the first couple of years, the Celtics, the St. Louis Hawks, who were the Celtics' first rival. Celtics-Hawks was a big thing in the early parts of the NBA. So here is the conversation with me and Mike Dinan.
Welcome back as we continue our historical deep dive into the Boston Celtics. If you've missed last week's shows, Tuesday through Friday, you missed the 50s. And that goes back to the birth of the Boston Celtics, the BAA days, the merger with the NBL that created the NBA, Walter Brown hiring Red Auerbach, the Bob Cousy stories that I've been talking about. If you've missed any of that stuff, then go back and listen to last week's shows because you get the basis, the foundation for what becomes the greatest run of basically in any sport. The Celtics in the 60s only go 1 year without winning an NBA championship. It's a remarkable run. It's the birth of the Celtics-Lakers rivalry, which is more like the Celtics beating down the Lakers very often. And here, again, to talk about it all week with me, Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com. Mike is an excellent writer for us on Reds Army when I was running Reds Army with Chuck McKinney, and also a Celtics historian. And now as we get into the 60s, Mike, you get your first hand, like you were there watching a lot of these games.
Hi, John. Yeah. Yes, I was. I started following the team in 1965. It was 65-66. That was Reds' last year on the bench as the coach.
So let's go back since we did the 50s last week, but we have to dip back into the 50s because we didn't talk about Sam Jones. Sam Jones is known as a 60s star for the Celtics, a guy who's key in a lot of these championships from basically like 1962 and on. But Sam Jones, who I contend is maybe the most underrated Celtic of all time, maybe one of the most underrated NBA superstars of all time, he was almost a Laker. Mike, why don't you walk us through how that almost happened?
Yeah, he was originally drafted in 1956. He went to a small school called North Carolina Central. And the Lakers, who were in Minneapolis at the time, drafted him with the 30th pick in the 1956 draft. But he was in the military, and so he wasn't available. He went back into college after he finished the military, and he completed his degree, and then he went into the draft a second time in 1957. And that is when the Celtics picked him with the 8th selection.
So continuing our pattern of things that almost didn't go the Celtics' way. If you recall, we had Red Auerbach almost becoming the Duke head coach, but not feeling good about waiting for that head coach to die of cancer, so he left. We had the Celtics twice trying to pass on Bob Cousy and ultimately having him just kind of thrust upon them. We have the Icecapades playing a role in getting Bill Russell. And now we have Sam Jones, who instead of becoming a Laker, which in today's society, in today's kind of NBA where you just come out and you play, like back then you could do what he did in military service. Like that was a huge deal back then. Everybody had to do it. And for him to go back and complete his degree and then come to the Celtics is another, because he's like, we talked last week, Mike, about Mr. Clutch, the Jerry West. Sam Jones is the real Mr. Clutch, especially in this era of the 60s.
He is to me. I think of him as the forgotten superstar of that era. I saw a couple of years ago ESPN online, ESPN.com. They had a series of top 10 at each position in the NBA in historical, where they picked the top 10 shooting guards. Sam Jones wasn't one of them. He had 10 rings. I don't understand what you have to do to get on that list. But, you know, he had any number of achievements besides the 10 rings. He had 1962. He had a series winning shot. He hit a jumper with 2 seconds left in game 7 to beat Philadelphia. He had in 1963, game 7, 47 points against the Cincinnati Royals, which was Oscar Robertson's team. He, in the era back in the 50s, admittedly, they did not shoot well back then. A good shooting percentage was 40% for an individual. Right. And Sam, for his career, shot almost 46%. And in the playoffs, the same, 45%. I saw him in person score 51 points at New York in the old Madison Square Garden in a series closeout game against the Knicks, 1967. And then another thing that I saw him in person, 1969, the NBA Finals in Boston. The Celts were down 2-1 to the Lakers. They had to win game 4 because the next game was going to be in L.A. and they would have been facing elimination. They were down by 1 point, and Sam hit a jump shot off a triple screen with 7 seconds left, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
They won the game by a point. They survived. If he had missed, that would have probably been the end of the run. Instead, he made the shot. They ended up winning game 6 and game 7 on the road, and he and Russell finished their careers going out on top.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
It's an amazing run. And, you know, Bill Russell talks about, here's a direct quote. In the years that I played with the Celtics, in terms of total basketball skills, Sam Jones was the most skillful player that I ever played with. That's Bill Russell saying that about a player. The most skillful player that I ever played with. To your point, they asked him to take 6 season-saving shots over the course of that 8 straight championships. 6 different times they threw him the ball. 6 different times he made the shot. But it wasn't always roses for Sam Jones. In fact, when he first got to Boston, he was upset that he was part of the Celtics, because he got there and he thought, you know, I'm not going to play. He says, here's a direct quote from Sam Jones. I was shocked when the Boston Celtics drafted me in the first round. I didn't play for a big program like Kansas or Kentucky. I was the first African-American from a black college to be drafted in the first round of any sport. And he goes on to say, like, he thought that he, by going to the Celtics, that he was going to be behind Bob Cousy, that he was going to be behind other great players of the time. So he wasn't too happy right away.
Well, I can understand that if you're going to have to be behind Bob Cousy, Bill Sharman, Hall of Famers. Cousy was an MVP, 1957. You know, you want to go somewhere where you're going to get to play, but I think it worked out all right for him.
Yeah, oh, totally. It totally did. And back then, as opposed to now, there were only 10 active players on a roster. So it's not like they were carrying 15 guys. They had 10 10 active players. And at that point, he thought that maybe he just wasn't going to make those 10. Ultimately, he broke through. And he broke through a little bit later on. So let's pause the Sam Jones discussion to because his first real breakout, I think, was that 1960. He was okay. Like it's 60, 61, 61, 62. Like 61, 62, he was an all-star. And that's when he really started to make that run. Bob Cousy retires in, what, 63?
Yes.
And then he takes over and he goes. Then Sam Jones becomes a star. In the meantime, the Celtics are starting their run. Okay, so in 57, we already talked about it, they beat the Hawks. In 58, they lost to the Hawks. And then in 59, they beat the Lakers. So coming into this decade, we have Boston Celtics with three straight championships. And honestly, to begin this whole run, it was the St. Louis Hawks that were their biggest rivals. Like I said, 57, they win. 58, they lose. In 59-60 and the 60-61 season, they go ahead, they play the Hawks again and beat the Hawks for their first two of their monster run in the 60s. So, and as we discussed, Mike, last week, that Hawks team was loaded and that trade that the Celtics made kind of helped them along with that.
Yes, it did. When they got Ed McCauley and Cliff Hagan from the Celtics in exchange for the draft position that the Celtics took Russell. But let's give a shout out to the Hawks because they really had a key role in so many ways. Just quick recap of all the things they did for the Celtics. They let Auerbach go. Auerbach was their coach.
Right.
He resigned because he wasn't getting along with the owner. They got Bob Cousy, and then they couldn't sign him. And that's how he ended up in that dispersal draft.
Yep.
And then they made the trade that gave Russell to Boston, and they lost three times in four finals against the Celtics. So, and unfortunately for them, 58 was the last time they have won. In fact, they haven't been in the finals since they played the Celtics, and that's gone on 60 years.
Yeah. So that's right. The Hawks fans, we talked about it a little bit yesterday with Chuck. The Hawks fans haven't had anything close to that. Well, close, I should say, but they haven't had that level of success since the team was in St. Louis. So the most notable thing, though, so let's just, like you said, shouting out the Hawks just a little bit. When the Celtics gave up McCauley and Cliff Hagan, it's not like it was it's not like they were giving up scraps. You know, Cliff Hagan in that series, so in 1960, the 1960 NBA Finals, they went to seven games against the Hawks, and Cliff Hagan averaged almost 24 points, 10 rebounds in that series. Like, he, along with Bob Pettit, that they almost beat the Celtics. So the Celtics didn't just give up nothing. They gave up high-quality players. So we got to make sure that when we look back on that history, and I always flippantly say, I'm very guilty of flippantly saying, oh, the Celtics gave up the ice capades for Bill Russell. But they also gave up those two players who were all-time great players. So they paid a price. Obviously, it worked out, but they did give up a lot.
Yeah, they're both in the Hall of Fame, those two players. And the Hawks did come extremely close to beating the Celtics in 57. That seventh game, I think we talked about it last week, it went to double overtime. That had to be excruciating to watch.
Yeah.
And then the Celts were up two, and the Hawks had time only for like a one inbounds play with a couple of seconds left, and Pettit had a tip-in attempt, and it rolled off the rim as the buzzer sounded. So it would have tied the game, and they would have kept playing. Who knows? So
right.
The Celtics had good fortune on that play and on that season, and it carried from there.
So I think one of the more notable things, because the Hawks is almost like a footnote in as far as Celtics lore goes, you're like, oh yeah, they beat the Hawks. So making sure that we give those Hawks teams their proper due. But 1960 is also when Wilt Chamberlain shows up, and the Celtics, on their way to championships, have to get through Wilt Chamberlain. So 1960, Wilt is Rookie of the Year, MVP. He's averaging 37.5 points, 27 rebounds. And the Celtics have to go through the then Philadelphia Warriors, which was not the 76ers. The Philadelphia Warriors became the Golden State. They moved out to San Francisco. So Wilt's story, by the way, you know, going from Philly to San Francisco, back to Philly to play for the Sixers, and then ultimately back out to play for the Lakers, is its own wild ride. But 1960, the Celtics have to get through the Warriors, and that's not an easy task. But Tommy Heinsohn and Bill Russell combined to have a great what's then the Eastern Division Finals against the Philadelphia Warriors, which, I mean, Mike, the injection of Wilt into this whole equation is, it makes this road, everybody says what they say about that era. This was not an easy road for the Celtics to win these championships.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I think the only thing that they had easy was that you only had to win two playoff series back then.
Sure, yeah.
But the competition that they faced was pretty good. There was the quality of the league was condensed because you had fewer teams. So you had all the better players were on those few teams instead of having a team that even like the lower teams had two or three good players. And, you know, you had to go some to beat somebody. The Celtics, they had some luck, but they weren't always dominant. I mean, they had some competition over the years. They had times when they were very close to losing. They had, we'll get to it, I'm sure, but they have twice in 62 and 69, they were down 3-2 to the Lakers in the final, in the finals, and they came back and won. There was another time, it was Reds last season, 1966. They were in a five-game series with the Royals, and they were down 2-1. They had to win game four on the road to stay alive, and they did it. So, you know, the other teams in the league had good players. They had talent. You can't say the Celtics just walked over plumbers and insurance salesmen. Like a lot of people do, because, you know, there were plenty of all-time greats back in that day, in that era.
Hall of Famers all over the place. Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram. That Warriors team also had Paul Arizin, who was a really good player. And in that series, Wilt averaged 30.5 points, 27.5 rebounds per game in 45 minutes played. I mean, the numbers for centers back then were ridiculous. In that division finals, Russell averaged 20 points, almost 21 points, which is, you know, more than usual for him, and 27 rebounds. Just wild rebounding numbers because the shooting percentages were low back then, so there were a lot of rebounds to be had.
And the pace was high. Those were fast-breaking teams. Everybody ran. You know, there wasn't a lot of half-court offense, or at least not like you see today where teams are working the ball around the perimeter, looking for the rotation, get the man open in the corner for the three. They didn't do that then. You watch any of these replays that they're showing, like last night, 1976. They had the Sunday overtime. Night the triple overtime. Thank you. The 1976 against the Suns. That game was wild, but there was just up and down and a lot of turnovers actually. By the Celtics in particular. That's how Phoenix got back in the game. But there's no waiting around, no shot clock violations.
Yeah, no, certainly no shot clock violations. And that's the style of play back then. As strategies developed, then you have counter strategies, and that's what slows things down. And you know, the quality of the athlete certainly has improved over the course of time. I mean, I can't imagine Bill Russell in today's NBA with as gifted an athlete as he is, one of the most gifted athletes in NBA history, never mind the winning, never mind the basketball, just one of the most gifted athletes, with today's medical science, with the training and the practice facilities, and you know, imagining those guys, imagine Wilt in a weight room just working out and making himself even stronger. And he was a man among boys. Like, he really was just too big and too strong, too dominant, like just naturally strong. Imagine him having nothing else to do besides hit the weights. I mean,
well, with Wilt, he had something else to do all the time.
Well, but, sure.
Yeah, that's another topic.
As I was talking, I'm like, I knew that was going to be the response. Well, Wilt might have had a little extra, a little something extra. Okay, so the Celtics get through the Warriors, and in 60, they beat the Hawks, like I said. In 1960, Bob Cousy's a first-team All-NBA guy. Bill Russell's a second-team All-NBA guy, and Charmin is a second-team All-NBA guy. Basically, Wilt shows up, and Russell is now a second-team All-NBA guy. We get into 61, an important draft here because they draft Satch Sanders in 1961. And Mike, Satch is another underrated guy. And I'm glad I saw Satch at a game this year. And like, I pride myself on not getting starstruck with players, but like, I literally turned the corner. I see Satch Sanders sitting there with his bow tie. And I was like, oh, hello, Mr. Sanders. I said to him, I want to say more things to you, but I can't think of anything. So I just want to say hi. He's an important figure here, and he was drafted in 1961.
Yeah, Satch is, you look at him and it's regal. He's regal looking.
Yes.
He has a presence. He's Jaylen Brown a little bit reminds me of Satch in the way that his personality and the way he presents himself and comes across. Satch went to NYU and coached at Harvard. So he is a thinker, and he was known for his defense, but he could hit a jump shot too.
Yeah. So Satch comes along. And here we go, 61, same thing here. The Celtics have to go through Wilt. They have to go beat Philadelphia again. They beat the Hawks again. Bill Russell is now the MVP, but funny enough, and this happens again the following year, Bill Russell wins MVP, but is second team All-NBA, which is just funny to me.
You know, I think it speaks to that Wilt had all the numbers and Russell had the ring. And if the Celtics were still the top team in wins and losses, which they were, you could see that's where Russell came in, had his influence. He didn't have to score 30 a game. Wilt did. And so, you know, I mean, it's odd, but it wouldn't happen today. But it happened, I think, a couple of times that worked out where Russell won the MVP, even though he wasn't first team.
Yeah, he happened the next year. Russell was the MVP in 62 and was a second team All-NBA guy. In fact, in 61, it was Russell MVP, Cousy first team All-NBA, Russell and Heinsohn second team All-NBA. And then 62, Russell MVP, him, Cousy, and Heinsohn, all second-team NBA, All-NBA.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in 1962, we're getting into the Los Angeles Lakers. So we've had all of this time. The Celtics have now, let's see, five rings, five titles. They've beaten the St. Louis Hawks. It was four titles at this point, right? 57, 59, 60, 61. So sorry.
Yes.
So
yes.
Four titles. They've beaten the Hawks three times, and they've beaten the Lakers once. Now the Hawks are done. They're out. Splitsville. See ya. Now it's the Lakers' turn.
Starting tomorrow on the Wednesday show, we'll get into Celtics, Lakers. And this is billed as the beginning of the rivalry. Not really the beginning of the rivalry, to be honest with you. This is more the beginning of the Celtics and Lakers meeting a lot of times in the playoff, in the finals. It's not going well for the Lakers in the 1960s. They faced the Celtics many, many times, and it does not go well for them. There are a ton of great stories between the Celtics and Lakers from a Boston perspective in the 1960s, and we'll continue to talk about that. We'll really get into that on the Wednesday Locked On Celtics podcast. So please go ahead and subscribe to the show if this is your first time listening. Really appreciate you going ahead and subscribing. The historical deep dives are going to continue. Next week will be the 70s. Then we'll do the 80s, the 90s, 2000s. We'll go all the way up until present time. And so we'll ride out this hiatus as best we can by really going through the entire history of the Boston Celtics. So once again, last week, 1950s. This week, 1960s. Next week, 70s, and we go on. So a subscription that will get you this show to your device on a daily basis. A five-star rating and a good written review would be exceptional. I'd really appreciate that. But more so, I'd really appreciate you going to gbfb.org. Scroll down to the Jason Tatum Foundation's Team JT0 fundraiser and donate to his fundraiser for the Greater Boston Food Bank. He will match up to $250,000. So your donations will get matched by him. That's $500,000 for Boston people in need. And along with Bradley Beal and his matching of $250,000, they're committing to matching $500,000. You raise $500,000, you get $1 million to feed people. That goes a very, very long way, thanks to the efforts by the amazing folks at the Greater Boston Food Bank. They do wonderful work. People depend on the Greater Boston Food Bank. So if you could, anything, seriously, anything, $2, $5, $10, whatever you can, if you can. And it's if you can. I understand this is a tough time, but that's what we do in tough times as Americans. We put all our differences aside and we help each other out. And this is one of those times. So if you can, please do it. I'm going to donate my own $250. That's what I can do. I will, you send me the receipts. I will match that $250. So we're really trying to get some help to the people who are in need. That's at gbfb.org. Again, tomorrow we continue on our deep dives into the 60s with Celtics, Lakers. So please listen to that and tell your friends, share the podcast. Tell everybody, listen to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network.